LGBT people have made remarkable gains in the past four decades, from being often closeted and generally illegal to becoming vocal and powerful in many fields and communities throughout the United States. But how substantial have those gains really been? In his sixth book, It's Not Over, Getting Beyond Tolerance, Defeating Homophobia, and Winning True Equality, Huffington Post editor-at-large, radio host, and LGBT activist Michelangelo Signorilli assesses the modern gay rights movement and warns that recent victories may be fleeting and the battle for true equality is far from won. We spoke in April, and we're rebroadcasting that conversation for you today. Recent events in Indiana and Arkansas seem to speak to your views on the continuing need for aggressive activism for LGBT rights. Why do you think those laws have come forward now?
Well, I think that people sometimes get sort of swept up in the moment of victories and think, aha, we've won, and don't realize how powerful the animosity and backlash toward LGBT people is, and those who oppose equality will continue organizing, and that's what they were doing.
Although they say this is just a continuation of a federal law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, but wasn't that originally intended to apply to something very different than same-sex marriage?
It was initially meant to apply to employees individuals not to be discriminated against on the basis of their religion by their employer or an association. And what happened with Hobby Lobby and then what this law did in Indiana was to make companies into individuals.
Actually, one of the reasons initially was that there was concern that certain Native American groups were being prevented from using peyote as part of their religious rituals. And so this gave them an exemption.
And their employers were discriminating, yeah.
As a journalist and radio host, you've had opportunities to speak with a lot of influential figures, conservative people, on this issue. How did what are they telling you? And how did the religious freedom angle develop for them?
Well, I spent a lot of time at events like the Conservative Political Action Conference over the past few years, the Values Voters Summit, where conservatives organize and kind of it's like their laboratory where they come up with new strategies. I covered it for my radio program on Sirius XM, but also in researching this book and seeing how they were saying, what are the ways we can kind of cordon ourselves off from this whole gay rights thing and protect ourselves from having to deal with gay marriage? And that's where they really started to develop this religious freedom angle, turn themselves into the victims, see if they could find a way, as they have with the issue of abortion and with women's rights in general, a way that they can captivate the larger public's discomfort in a way that can grab some of the people in the middle.
It's become so much a part of the popular culture that it was the subject of The Good Wife's
amazing timing last night. I'm a big watcher of the show.
When pushback became so great that the Indiana legislature felt it necessary to revive the law last week, the New York Times quoted Sarah Warbelow of the Human Rights Campaign saying that the revisions were a significant step in the right direction. Do you agree?
No, I wouldn't say a significant step. I think that the damage was mitigated slightly. Indiana has no protections for LGBT people in employment, in housing, in public accommodations statewide. So the cities have them, but they're very weak, and the rest of the state has none.
The state was surprised by the kind of response they got. Political leaders have imposed bans on Indiana and Arkansas as a result of the laws. Many business leaders have objected, but on purely business grounds. Is that a triumph?
I don't think it is. I think it's a short-term fix. Use whatever you have, but you have to change hearts and minds. And the other side can use business too. Maybe Chick-fil-A will start investing in Indiana a bit more.
Well, there's a Chick-fil-A coming to New York.
That's right.
But also the pizza parlor that claimed that they would not cater a wedding for gay couples, although I don't know too many gay couples that want to be, have their weddings catered by a pizza parlor. They got $800,000 in donations.
Upwards of $1 million, yes. Yeah. And I think it shows the force out there and the anger out there, the backlash out there, backlash among religious conservatives.
The LA Times, on the other hand, reported today that the religious freedom laws actually have helped gay rights in Indiana and Arkansas, that the social conservatives have shot themselves in the foot.
I think that they are sent back to the laboratory to come up with another plan, and they will. And they will figure out yet another way to try to create a wedge.
The Supreme Court has been hearing arguments in a case that may determine whether or not states can ban same-sex marriage. Are you willing to predict what they will decide?
I think it's fairly clear where the Supreme Court is going. I think what we saw with letting the ruling stand in the Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit, it really showed that the court was going the direction of full marriage equality. I think now it's a question of—
Despite the fact that there's a conservative majority?
Yes, I think that Justice Kennedy has been clear on the issue. But how will it be decided, on what legal theory? That is what will really affect these other issues we're talking about.
Why did gay rights leaders decide to focus on marriage rights instead of making things like employment discrimination a top priority?
Well, employment discrimination has been something that gay leaders in Washington have been focused on in terms of a federal bill for over 20 years. It never got any traction in Congress. I've say, in It's Not Over, part of the problem is we don't think big. We ask for too little, and it doesn't come across as if we're serious. The marriage movement was asking for something big and captivated the public's imagination, and it was grassroots driven.
But now that gays and lesbians in most states have the right to marry, why aren't other forms of legal protection falling into place?
Because a lot of these wins have been based on judicial decisions, and that's a great thing. That's what the judiciary does. But also, I think in the end, most people, most Americans look at it and say, you know what, this doesn't affect me. It's two people, and what do I care? When you get to the issue of civil rights laws, protections in business and housing and in public accommodation, that's when it starts asking the question to people, well, it affects me. Why do I have to serve these people? And that's, I think, a harder thing to really get the public to understand.
Bobby Jindal of Louisiana is defending the rights of private businesses to deny some services to same-sex couples. He expressed discomfort at providing non-discrimination protections to LGBT individuals on Sunday morning. That's yesterday morning on NBC's Meet the Press, when Chuck Todd asked him whether he supports ordinances in cities like New Orleans that say it's illegal to discriminate against the LGBT community in housing, employment, and public accommodations and facilities. He answered, I don't think certainly that there should be discrimination against anybody in housing and employment. That's not what my faith teaches me.
Yeah. Well, I talk a lot in the book about the new dog whistle, right? They're now dog whistling to the Christian conservatives. We don't support discrimination. We're the victims now, religious liberties. And what they are seeing is that the public does support marriage equality, but and if you ask the question, like, do you think gays should be discriminated against, people say no by a large majority. But if you ask the question, should a baker on religious grounds be able to say, I don't want to serve these people for their wedding, a recent poll showed the majority, even of those who support marriage equality, said yes. So they are knowing the issue to hit on that they can get that discomfort in the public.
Why the disconnect?
The disconnect between the issue on the baker mm-hmm. and the—
And now we have this third thing where a baker decided, said he wouldn't,
right.
he wouldn't put an anti-gay slogan on a cake.
Right.
And he has come under, he's had death threats.
Yeah, I think it's because on the issue of homosexuality, for too long, the idea of religious opposition has kind of been allowed. And I think gay advocates have sometimes fed into that. It's kind of been excused or allowed as a reason to have discomfort, to have some sort of opposition. But we saw these arguments with race. We saw that people were opposed to equality for African Americans, that they would say it was part of their religion. We saw that the KKK was operating on a religious conviction. And I think we really have to hit it that way head on.
My guest is Michelangelo Signorelli. His latest book is It's Not Over, Getting Beyond Tolerance, Defeating Homophobia, and Winning True Equality. You're critical of what you call incrementalism, the slow and gradual whittling writing and passing of protective legislation for LGBT people. Is it realistic to expect our political system, such as it is, to be capable of passing one comprehensive equal rights bill?
I think that you have to put it out there and you have to captivate the public's imagination and make people get used to it. Bella Abzug, the great Bella Abzug, of course, congresswoman from here in New York back in the 70s, she initially proposed a comprehensive civil rights bill for gays. The gay rights establishment changed that. They got scared when Anita Bryant whipped up the anti-gay crusade. AIDS came along and there was a backlash. And they said, let's go for just asking for a little bit. We should have stayed with Bella Abzug's idea. By now, that same bill would have been introduced over and over and over again. And it wouldn't be so shocking for us to ask for full civil rights.
Well, now that gay marriage is legal in many states, have some gay rights activists felt that it's time to be more accommodating to conservatives, as David Brooks recommended the other day in one of his New York Times op-ed columns?
That was a classic example of what I call in the first chapter of my book, Victory Blindness. That is the title of the first chapter, where activists believe that we've gotten so much and now we have to look magnanimous. We shouldn't be rocking the boat too much. We shouldn't be so demanding. And I think that's a trap, and that is ceding territory to these people who are trying to take away your rights.
What about – do you see any parallels to the criticism of outing of high-profile LGBT people early in your career and then calling out or shaming people on the opposite side of the aisle today?
Well, I think all of it is about pointing to hypocrisy and pointing to a duplicity and contradictions. When you have a closeted public figure who is voting anti-gay and you have these individuals who are saying, we won't serve gays, but then they'll serve a divorced person or somebody else who doesn't conform to their faith, that's hypocrisy.
You describe what happened to former Mozilla CEO Brendan Eich when it was discovered that he donated to a number of anti-gay organizations. Is shaming an accurate way to describe the way you call free market activism fighting back against people like Eich on social media?
Well, it's interesting what happened with Eich. There wasn't a real shaming of him by gay activists at all. And what I write about is how the right wing really kind of took that story and distorted it and made it seem like gay activists had attacked him, when in fact it was mostly people who work with Mozilla, a very unique company because it's a foundation and most of the developers donate their time, who said, we don't feel comfortable working for a company with a guy who gave money to Prop 8 and gave money to Pat Buchanan. And so I think what you had was Mozilla making a business decision of like, we're going to lose our developers. We've got to let this guy go.
Well, if that logic was applied to businesses, then pretty much every major bank in America, every major investment company would lose support. Instead, we see it with Mozilla and the L.A. Clippers.
Right. I think that's why the right-wing backlash against what happened with Mozilla was so swift. They realized that Mozilla was pretty unique, as I said, as a company. But if this started to happen with other companies, they get money from CEOs who are, you know, very much pro-business CEOs. They give it to right-wing conservatives who are also anti-gay. Money could be jeopardized, and I think that's why they saw it as very threatening.
It took Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, a long time before he decided to come out.
It did. He really
would he have had to deal with anti-gay bias in the past?
I certainly don't think so. There are many people calling for him to come out, you know, online with the internet now. Everybody, you know, talks about all this stuff anyway. And he was showing up at gay pride events and going to things he just hadn't said. And I think it really probably took some people to make the case to him of how he could be impactful if he just came out and said it.
What about gay rights activism? Trans rights activists have gained more visibility in the last decade. But do you think that the gay rights community has always been a supportive ally?
No, I think transgender activists have really done the enormous work to not just educate the public, but educate the larger gay community about how they've been marginalized and how they've sort of been shunted aside. You know, this respectability politics where everybody wants to show that we're just like everybody else, it hides the differences. And transgender activists have said, you know, you've shoved us into the closet. I have a whole section on what I call covering. I actually am quoting the scholar Kenji Yoshino, whose book Covering talks about how it's very limiting when you just sort of cover up who you are and don't focus on the difference. You don't change minds.
There is even controversy over the use of words like tranny, acceptable on shows like RuPaul's Drag Race, but people find it insulting otherwise.
There have been huge debates among transgender activists and gay activists about the use of these words, as I think we see in the black community with the N-word. And I think, you know, leave it to the communities to figure it out. What gets me most angry is when people say, well, why can't I use it if you're using it? Well, why do you need to use it?
You acknowledge that the LGBT community is a very large umbrella. Do all the members of this diverse community face the same kinds of discrimination?
No, I think we come together, we intersect on certain issues, but every one of them is very unique. Lesbians are obviously dealing with sexism and dealing with sexism within the movement and misogyny as well. Bisexual people have a very unique kind of animosity that is generated toward them, sometimes by both gay people and straight people. So I think all of them have very unique things that they experience, but where they come together is on that difference from the mainstream on gender and sexuality.
You make a lot of references to the struggle for other oppressed groups in the United States, but there have been, in the civil rights movement, many people said gay rights is not the same thing as civil rights for minority groups.
Well, I think that's changing really at such a fast pace. Certainly our president, African-American, certainly people like Al Sharpton.
But it took the president how many years before
it's
changed
true.
His position?
It's true.
And I
think
Hillary Clinton also only recently changed her position.
I think he helped to change others. But Coretta Scott King was out front supporting gay marriage as well. I think it has changed. And what I wrote this book really to kind of show people was that what they may be seeing about the gay rights movement, you know, the victories, it's not really accurate. It is similar to the backlash we've seen against African Americans and against women as well, which we can learn from. And certainly I think the gay rights movement learns from and stands on the shoulders of the black civil rights movement.
Many people say, well, somebody can be bigoted in this area until they realize that their child, their relative, their friend is gay. Do you think that's really a factor? And what about the popular culture where we're seeing so many shows these days that are very different in the way that they're dealing with gays than they did in the past?
Well, I think, and we've seen studies that have shown when people know someone who's gay, it does change their position, whether that is some character on television or somebody in their family. Look at Dick Cheney. He had a lesbian daughter, and he was more supportive.
But did it change his politics? But his sister was not.
And look at what he did. He still supported a president and was the vice president to a president who was writing a constitutional amendment against his daughter. So I think it only goes so far. People prioritize these things. If they're more concerned with, and this is why I get very, I don't really trust these polls that say, oh, young people now support gay rights more. Well, what's their priority? If their priority, even if they're Republicans, is that they want their taxes cut, that's who they'll vote for, even if that person's anti-gay.
Are producers of entertainment having trouble adjusting to the added responsibility of authentic representation? Think of shows like Mike and Molly, Modern Family, The Dallas Buyers Club, which many people thought was very sympathetic to gays, but it was, you know, many gays found offensive.
Well, Dallas Buyers Club, great film focused on AIDS in the 80s. HIV is happening still. The transmission rate, the infection rate is still at the same as it was, and it's invisible in the lives of gay people on television or in Hollywood. Hollywood has been really just way behind for an institution that considers itself progressive and liberal. It has not showed the reality of LGBT people. It has sanitized them or covered them, as I call them, call it, because it has kind of made them palatable and sexless to heterosexuals.
Does HIV/AIDS is the conversation about HIV/AIDS changing, especially with the arrival of something like Truvada?
It is certainly changing how gay men talk about prevention, and obviously you now have a drug that people can take that can prevent HIV, and it has created enormous discussion. We're not seeing that discussion among, you know, characters on television, certainly. We're not seeing it really that much in the media. And what is more important is that it's one part of the toolkit, and the government still, even under the Obama administration, has not done the kind of prevention campaigns that are about promoting condoms, promoting PrEP, promoting all of these things, Truvada, that we really need to end transmission of HIV.
There's been tremendous infighting within the community over Truvada. Is the medication getting to people who need it most? That's a second question.
No. What I talk about in the book, in It's Not Over, looking at what epidemiologists are saying, you would need to get at least 50% of the best candidates, which are low-income African-American gay men and transgender women on this treatment. You'd need to get way more HIV-positive people in treatment. You'd need to still get people tested every 3 months, and you'd need to increase condom use among everyone by 15%. So it and that would only bring it down by 35%, the infection rate. So it's not getting to the people who it could. And there's still so much else that you need to do in conjunction with it.
Former Republican Congressman Aaron Schock was forced to leave office because of mishandling of funds. But why do you think that so many are saying he might be gay, and should it matter?
It does matter, and it is something the media has had a double standard about. He, in the beginning, just sort of, to a lot of gay men, gave off the visual cues of someone who might be gay. But then rumors started to surface. A former CBS reporter wrote about an incident where a friend of his had some sort of involvement with the congressman, wrote about it on Facebook. It took off. It was even discussed in the Washington Post. Reporters didn't follow up on it. They didn't see it as an issue of hypocrisy. He voted against the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He said he supported a federal marriage amendment. But the moment that they see that his office is decorated lavishly, suddenly they're looking at every expenditure in the way that he's spending. Why didn't they look at that other issue? Why wasn't that a priority?
Now, you mentioned earlier that polls suggest that at least millennials, but probably now, I think it's a slim majority of Americans, support gay rights. And yet, it's the courts that pretty much have made the decisions along these lines, not state legislatures. There have been a few state legislatures, a few governors, but generally, some in New York State paid a price for supporting legislation that Andrew Cuomo proposed. Why do you think there's been this that kind of disconnect?
Well, think about it. You have a slim majority supporting marriage equality, but that other 40-something percent is still – they're not just indifferent. They are still very, very actively opposed to it.
And why do you think that is? Is it just religious, or is there something else going on?
I think it is the religion issue. We live in a country where, you know, over 25% of people are evangelical Christian. Many of the states we're talking about where there are no protections are throughout the South and the West. And that's where you're seeing now with legislatures, and we just saw in the last election, taken over by Republican governors and Republican state houses, I think the largest surge in since the 1920s. I think it's going to be a long slog to get these laws passed in the states.
And what do you suggest that people do to try to change things?
people have to really, I think, engage in the kind of activism that we've seen happen in the last several years with regard to really pushing President Obama on the issue, multi-pronged.
It took Joe Biden to push President
That's right.
Obama.
But there were marches on Washington. There were online campaigns. And there was this idea of we're not going to settle, and really pushing hard and making the case. That is where I say this incrementalism has got to stop. People don't take you seriously if you say, just give us a little bit.
You say, go for the whole thing and then accept what you can get.
Absolutely. Fight it out and see what you get.
Michelangelo Signorelli is the author of Queer in America, which was a best-selling book. He hosts the Michelangelo Signorelli Show on Sirius XM Progress, editor-in-large of the Huffington Post Gay Voices Vertical. And he has written for many different publications. The most recent is his new book. It's called It's Not Over, Getting Beyond Tolerance, Defeating Homophobia, and Winning True Equality. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me again.